No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Di Noor, and this is still the Pledge Drive, and we have two of my ever most favorite speakers today. The second half of the hour, we will be talking to Bill Fletcher about the future of labor. But for the first, for the next 25 minutes, we will be talking to a man I know you all appreciate very much, Professor Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor Emeritus in the MIT Department of Linguistics and Philosophy, public intellectual, author of numerous books, and we are not going to pledge rap. We are going to dedicate the entire 25 minutes to talking to Professor Chomsky, who I have to say, when we were working on organizing this show, his assistant made me swear that we'll let him go at 12:30 because he's given us a half of the only hour that he has in many, many months. Noam Chomsky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you again.
And you know, I really appreciate that you're giving us this this little bit of time that you have. It's really wonderful of you. I was thinking that we should talk about the news of the day. Let's start with the sequester, which is starting today. How do you explain that in the larger context of what's happening in this country and in the world? And also, since you are really a professor of linguistics, I wonder if you think if this is a right use of the word.
What's been happening is significant. I mean, there was a substantial redesign of the economy in the 1970s. It escalated under Reagan and was carried forward by his successors. The economy shifted from towards financialization, towards enormous growth of the financial sector. So if you go back to the 50s and the 60s, you know, the big growth period, in fact, greatest growth period in American history, and you take a look at the financial sector, there were banks, of course, but banks were doing basically what banks are supposed to do in a state capitalist economy. So you'd put your money into, if you had some extra money, you'd put it in the bank. The bank would lend it to someone for some constructive purpose, you know, buy a house, start a business, whatever it might be. There weren't interstate banks, and banks were not engaged in complex financial transactions. Well, that all changed in the 70s, and the financial system exploded. In the 50s and the 60s, there were no financial crises, for one thing, because of the nature of the financial institutions, for another, because New Deal regulations were in place, and they, like the Glass-Steagall Act and others, and they constrained what banks could do, so it worked in order, and as I said, it was a great growth period. From the 70s, the financial sector exploded. Much bigger banks involved not in investment and lending, but in complex transactions, you know, exotic financial instruments, basically ways of making money by speculation, by very rapid trading, by other gimmickry. That led very quickly to a concentration of production. Did continue; it didn't stop. It was just mostly shipped overseas, where owners could and managers could make higher profits by a super exploitation of workers under horrendous conditions and for very low wages. No need to be concerned about the environmental conditions that were beginning to be initiated, primarily by Nixon, who was really the last liberal president we've had. So you had a continuation of production, but hollowing out the domestic industrial core. And effectiveness, and this, as I said, escalated sharply under Reagan, it led to concentration of income. By now we have the highest inequality in American history and far greater than other countries. A collapse of the not very strong social system. So by now, for example, the OECD, the Organization of Rich Countries, just did published a study on social justice, various dimensions. The United States ranked 27th out of 31, right next to Mexico. And it's not because it's a poor country. It's, you know, the richest and most powerful major country in world history has incomparable advantages. But this is part of the redesign of the society. For a large majority of the population, it's been a period of pretty much stagnation and decline. For a very small sector, it's been a spectacular wealth. Concentration of wealth leads to concentration of political power almost automatically, and that leads to legislation which carries the vicious cycle further. Legislation like, for example, deregulation. Since the early 80s, there have been repeated financial crises, each one worse than the last. We're now getting ready for the next one. For the big banks, it's not much of a problem because they have a government insurance policy. It's called too big to fail. That actually enters into their credit ratings. They're given higher ratings because credit agencies know they're going to be bailed out by the taxpayer next time there's a crash. They also get lower interest and so on. And this is not a small amount of money. It's been estimated by economists in the tens of billions of dollars, but now there's a careful study that just came out, actually a couple days ago. The International Monetary Fund did a study of this. It's reported in the current business press, Bloomberg. And it turns out by their estimates that virtually the entire profit of the big banks comes from a taxpayer subsidy. That is the benefits they get by the government insurance policy. One of the, maybe the leading financial correspondent in the English-speaking world, the most respected one, Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, described the financial institutions as like a larva that eats away at its host, the market system, and destroys it. And that's pretty much what it is. It's enormously powerful. Okay, let's get back to the political. There was a parallel development in the political system. Both parties, the cost of elections began to rise spectacularly. That drives both parties even deeper into the pockets of the corporations and the very wealthy. And they were always there, but now much deeper. The Republicans just went off the spectrum. They're no longer a parliamentary party in any traditional sense. They're kind of in lockstep uniformity, a service to the very rich and the corporate sector. Actually, that's the main thing that lies behind the current sequester. The rich and the corporations are very much undertaxed. Their rate of taxation has been dropping steadily right through this period. And there is a minor deficit problem. It's not a big problem. The big problem is joblessness. Even the Ben Bernanke, the chair of the Federal Reserve, just pointed that out. The business press has been saying it for a long time. But the banks and the financial institutions, they don't like the deficit. So therefore, the two political parties, such as they are, focus, and the political class, focus almost entirely on the minor problem of the deficit, not the major problem of loss of jobs. That's just people, who cares about them. In order to overcome the deficit, you know, as I say, not a major problem, but to overcome it, what you ought to do is obviously move taxation back to earlier levels. so the wealthy would pay much more taxes. But the Republican Party, now no longer a party, is dead against this, will not permit it. You read John Boehner today, it's off the table. We cannot have any taxation of the rich. It's not because the population doesn't want it. You look at polls, the public thinks, yeah, that's the best way to deal with the deficit. But for the agents of the super rich and the financial corporations, other corporations, for their agents, they don't want it. They want cutback of services. They're really aiming for cutback of anything that is of benefit to the general population, like Social Security, Medicare, and so on. But, of course, they'll never give up maintaining the powerful state, which comes to their rescue every time they crash the economy. And, as I just said, may even account for practically all of their profits. So that's the system we're moving into. Actually, that's not the worst problem. The worst problem is that the corporate sector and the wealthy, who are a very class-conscious group, much more so than in other societies, they are dedicated to short-term profit. Damn the consequences. And a very striking example of this, and one that may do us all in, is the attitude towards the environmental crisis. It's very serious. It, each read today's papers, new evidence reported about the effect of carbon emissions on climate change, the knocking the props out of one of the last contrarian arguments. A couple of days ago, there was a study in the main science journal of 500 years of permafrost, which concluded that even slight rises in temperature, less than is anticipated, are very likely to melt the permafrost, releasing huge amounts of methane, worse than carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere, leading to an escalated crisis. I mean, we may be, it's not that long off. You know, the generation of our grandchildren, say, may be faced with a very severe crisis. But the corporate sector is working very hard to prevent anything to be done from being done about it. And their power in the United States is so strong that out of 110 relevant countries, the United States is the only one that doesn't have some kind of a national program for dealing with the climate crisis or even targets for renewable energies. And to make it more extreme, there's, I'm sure you know of this group, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, a corporate-funded group which writes legislation for state legislatures for the benefit of the very wealthy in the corporate sector and, you know, as I said, damn the consequences. Their latest project is a school project, K-12, for what they call balanced education. That's a code phrase, a pretty transparent one, that means teaching climate change denial. It's kind of like the religious sectors that are trying to introduce creationism by saying we have to have balanced teaching, you know, teach evolution science and creation science. Okay, now the schools are going to have to teach the consensus of the overwhelming majority of scientists, all the National Academies of Science, you know, the science journals, you teach that, and then you have to balance it by teaching claims that nothing's happening or don't worry about it and so on. The idea is to turn, you may recall a couple of weeks ago the Republican governor of Louisiana at the Republican Governors Conference warned the governors that the Republican Party is turning itself into the stupid party, right, and they're not going to succeed that way. Well, ALEC and its corporate sponsors want to turn us into the stupid nation, so therefore they'll be able to make more profit in the next couple couple of years, and if the whole thing goes down the tube, the next generation, it's somebody else's business. Well, when the big banks make risky transactions, hence profitable, with the knowledge that it's probably going to crash, when it does crash, they can run cap in hand to the nanny state and ask to be bailed out, which they are, which encourages risk, of course. On the other hand, when you destroy the environment, there's nobody to run to. That's it. And that's what we're heading towards. We have to become the stupid nation. We have to destroy labor. We have to shred democracy. We have to make sure that the very rich get everything they want. And for everyone else, it's too bad. That's the direction we're going. Mm-hmm. And while the Republicans have gone off the edge, the Democrats are going well to the right as well. I mean, the mainstream Democrats now are what used to be called the moderate Republicans. Maybe not even that. Okay, that's where we're heading. It doesn't have to be that way. But the only thing that can stop it is really large-scale popular mobilization, kind of took place in the 1930s or in the 1960s. And that can reverse, can restrain these developments and reverse them, whether it'll be in time to overcome the very negative consequences, well, we don't know. But I don't see any other. I think there's plenty of hope for that, but that's about it. Otherwise, we're going to go into the abyss.
Mm-hmm. I had a conversation last night, Noam, with a friend, and we were talking about whether we can and should say that we really are living under fascism now, and agreed that it's best to say that we live under a corporate rule of the government. There are so many aspects to that, and we have so little time to talk about it.
Well, there's a pretty straightforward, simple answer.
Yes.
I mean, a functioning democracy is a society which at a minimum, could be more than this, but at a minimum, government policy is influenced significantly by public opinion. I mean, that's an absolute minimum. Okay, let's take a look at us. Now, there are very good studies of this in the professional political science literature. And what they find briefly is that about 70% of the population, the lowest 70% on the income scale, have essentially no influence on policy. So they're basically disenfranchised. As you move up the wealth income scale, you get a little bit more influence. By the time you get to the very top, influence is overwhelming. Now, that's not a democracy. That's a plutocracy. And the Republicans are passionately dedicated to it. The Democrats more or less support it. And the main movements that opposed such developments, like the labor movement, that's been very badly weakened by state corporate assault for a long time, but especially during the Reagan years and since.
Let's switch in the last 5 minutes that we have. I would love to talk about Syria and see what your take is on what's going on there. But also an early caller who actually called before we started because he wanted me to ask you about the gun debate. What do you think about that? And I think considering
about
we have
what?
So
sorry,
little time, you choose.
Think about what?
The gun debate. The debate about guns and
which
one.
Oh, the gun debate.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So I guess I'll leave it up to you to choose which one of these two to take.
All right, let me take that since we're on domestic things.
All right.
It's quite interesting. I mean, first thing to remember is that the United States, way back to colonial times, has been a very frightened society. There's some quite good studies of this, see it in popular literature and politics and so on. This is kind of intriguing because it's the most secure society in the world. no external enemies, enormous power, and so on. That's increased very sharply in the last few years. I suspect it's partly a reaction to the general, what you almost might call sociocide, destruction of the society. As a society gets shattered, people get frightened. And by now, there's a substantial part of the population, not trivial, that thinks we need guns to protect ourselves from the federal government. Now, the idea is totally insane. If the federal government comes after you, an assault rifle is not going to do anything. But putting that aside, what it reflects is a fear and hatred of government, which means a fear and hatred of democracy. They're not collecting guns to save themselves from J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs and General Electric, rather from the evil government, you know, the one institution that exists that is at least partially under accountable to the public. That's another sign of the shredding of democracy. Now, a couple of years ago, 5 years ago to be exact, the Supreme Court, a very radical Supreme Court, reversed a long-standing precedent and revised the interpretation of the Second Amendment to make it far broader. So now when people talk about our sacred Second Amendment right to have guns, you know, in our pockets, and everyone talks about that, including Obama, they're talking about a right that was established 5 years ago in the sharp violation to the interpretation before in the courts, and also to the history and the plain meaning of the Second Amendment. I mean, no time to go through it, but if you read it and you think about the history, the Second Amendment was written with a concern that there be militias to defend the colonies from the British, who were a real danger then to the colonies. Well, you know, there's no militias, no British, no anybody else. There should be, you know, reasonable gun laws like other countries have. Homicides by guns, deaths by guns, suicides and homicides are way out of line with other countries. I mean, crime rate's about the same, but killings with guns is just, you know, in the stratosphere. And it's because of a combination of cultural factors like this incredible fear and gun laws that are just so lax that it's a bad joke. And it's not just the United States that suffers from this. Take, say, Mexico, where tens of thousands of people are being killed. The majority of the guns that are confiscated come from the United States. And people who walk into a store in Arizona or Texas, pick up a gun and hand it, sell it off to their favorite, you know, drug cartel dealer. It's a real plague. And the power of the gun lobby is so overwhelming that there haven't even been, they won't even permit, I mean, Congress will not permit itself to carry out studies, just studies of the effects of guns and gun regulation on killings with guns. So this is part of a general social pathology, which is really harming the country badly, quite apart from the killings themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, Noam Chomsky, I do have to let you go, or Bev will never let me have you again. I hope that maybe in a half a year or something we can have you again for the whole hour. It is always such a pleasure to have you with us. So I want to thank you for giving us this time. I know your time is very, very much accounted for. Yeah. And also for the books that you gave us and that you autographed. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, good to talk to you.
Yep, always bye. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye. Yep. And We have such an interesting second guest today, Bill Fletcher, past president of Trans-Africa Forum, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, editorial board member of blackcommentator.com, and a longtime labor activist and employee. And hello, Bill. So good to have you again with us.
I'm always glad to be on the program. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. Let's start with the war on unions and organized labor. I think a lot of us thought that unions were invincible, but they were defeated so easily. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I wouldn't say that they've been defeated easily.
No, you don't think so?
I'd say that there's been this war against unions that in the most recent past has been going on since the late 1970s. And so what we're dealing with is what they call in the military a war of attrition, where the unions have been worn down through continuous bombardments from the other side. And what we're going through right now is what I call the final offensive. This is the moment that corporate America and their right-wing political allies, like the governor of your great state,
yes,
believe that now is the time to annihilate unions entirely.
I guess when I say so easily, what shocked me is it just happened. He decreed, and it happened, and there were, at some point, 180,000 of us at the Capitol, but it did not make a difference. We don't have, at least in the public sector, we don't have unions anymore.
Well, the problem is that this didn't pop out of nowhere. So his move was made at precisely the moment when he believed that unions were weak enough that he could pull it off. I don't think that this was accidental or a coincidence or anything of the sort. So that's what I think we have to understand. The other thing is that, yes, there was a magnificent display of opposition to what the governor was trying in your state. I think that the problem, part of the problem, was that they had the votes, you know, in your state legislature. You had a very determined opponent in the form of the governor, and probably the only alternative, the only way that he could have been stopped is if the state had stopped.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking, are we general strike?
I think that that's the way that things are moving. And the problem is, though, that we have lost the historic memory about how to put together general strikes. The last general strike in the United States was in 1946 in the Taft-Hartley Act, which went into effect in 1948. General strikes were made illegal. So the problem is that if you're going to actually engage in something at that scale, people have to be prepared for the consequences. And so that's not something that you call loosely. It's not about putting out a post somewhere and expecting that people will simply respond to it. You have to do an amazing amount of education. Well, you know, your governor and his allies knew full well that the union movement wasn't prepared for that. And so you had that problem, and then there was the attempt at the recall, and there's been obviously a lot of debate about whether that was the appropriate tactic. All I would say at this point is that I think it was right for people to resist the injustice that was represented by your governor. And it lost, but I think it was right. It is always right to stand up to injustice.
I agree. So let's talk about general strike look like and what the ramifications may be, and also your thinking about what labor needs to do now, which I think is really the most important things. We are where we are. Where do we go from here?
I didn't hear the question, but I think that there was something very important about what the caller was saying in the beginning about how he felt that he had been forced out. And part of what he's probably talking about is that many unions, including the United Auto Workers, beginning in the early 1980s, started making tremendous concessions to employers. And the employers would come to them and say, we're going to shut down unless there's concessions. And most of the unions were incapable or unwilling to stand up to these concession demands and to fight back. And part of it was they had lost the ability to fight. It's sort of like the dodo bird, you know, that's now extinct. The dodo bird lost the ability to fly because it stopped flying over like thousands and thousands of years. It basically was able to get by without flying. So at the point when it was in danger, it couldn't fly. And in fact, it couldn't even recognize danger. And the union movement is much like the dodo bird. Hmm. It has lost, much of it has lost the ability or the memory of how to fight. So what ends up happening are these concessions that have been forced upon the unions. And in some cases, look, you have no choice. You're not in a position to fight back. You're going to have to make a concession. But it happened across the board. And so the anger that I could hear in that caller's voice, I absolutely understand.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, just to make sure that we get to it before the end of the hour. What does the labor movement, and I mean it in the largest sense of the world, not just the unions, what needs to be done now? What do people need to think about now and how to implement it?
It needs to build economic justice as a cause. And I think one of the best examples in the recent past was the Chicago teachers' strike and what the Chicago Teachers Union was able to pull off there. They face a situation where the mainstream media and the city government of Chicago had painted them as special interests. They did internal organizing and education. They went out to the community, and they flipped the script entirely. They turned the strike into a strike for the kids. And as a result, they were able to retain the support of the parents. That was about making the demands of the union part of a larger set of demands for economic justice. Now, we've done this many times. The problem, there was the Republic Windows occupation in Chicago back in 2008 and 2009. We've done this many times, but you have to have leadership that is prepared to throw the dice and to recognize we have nothing to gain by further praying that this is going to change. We've got to stand up. We can't be begging. We've got to be prepared to fight, but fight in a very different way, and reaching out to other segments of the community and making it clear that we're fighting for economic justice is a part of that. I mean, I think that was part of the problem, Essie, in the campaign that you had in Wisconsin, that it ended up being portrayed by your opposition as a fight around collective bargaining for the public sector, as opposed to being a fight against economic injustice.
Right. And when we talk about economic injustice, we do need to involve, don't we? And I will need a really quick answer. Immigrants and people who work in department stores and Walmarts, and we need to include everybody in it rather than just unionized people.
That's right. And in fact, it's most important to reach people who are not in unions, who are suffering the indignities associated with a non-union situation.
Yeah. Well, Bill Fletcher, thank you so much. And with you, too, I hope that we get to have a whole hour sometime in the next 6 months or so.
Okay.
Thank you
Call
so
anytime.
Much for joining
thank
us
you.
Today. Thank you.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get